After decades of user-based pricing being the most common model for software companies, is it time to rethink that approach? Well, why not bring in an executive from a company named Software Pricing Partners to find out? I am Thomas Law, the Executive Director of the Technology and Services Industry Association. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. Today, I will be talking with Chris Mealy, the managing partner at Software Pricing Partners, a firm that specializes in pricing software to maximize profitability. We will be discussing the legacy of software pricing and market forces that are now putting pressure on those models. Let's get the insight engine humming here. Welcome, Chris. It's great to see you again. And I want to open up with an easy one. How long has Software Pricing Partners been around? And what was the catalyst for this firm even getting created?
It's been around 44 years, so 82. Actually, 42 years.
I have a feeling you weren't there at the beginning.
No, I was not. 82, I was still pretty young. 10 years old. So the manner by which it came around was I started the software company and we moved to the cloud in 08. So it was about 10 years into that journey and we decided that we were going to replatform and the market was slowing down. We had no idea, by the way, of how much it was going to slow down. Yeah. And along the way, one of the investors said, hey, we really should procure some help. We're going to change our business model. We're looking at subscription. That's going to change our cash flow and all this other stuff. And then we reached out, talked to a bunch of firms that, frankly, were just talking about planes, trains, automobiles, and pricing things that you could touch. And of course, we're talking about things that you can't touch, intellectual property.
Yeah.
And when I met the team at Software Pricing Partners, I just kind of fell in love. I spent the next 4 or 5 years realizing that that's really kind of a big ingredient. It's got a lot of science and a lot of history to it and a lot of decisions that were gluing things together that were kind of unglued, but I didn't really understand that at the time. And then when I left that in 2013, I accepted a partnership position here. And then in 2018, bought the founding team out and continued the journey of applying technology now to that stack of what used to be professional services.
Well, that original, because I did not realize the firm had been around that long in that history, but the original team and when they started, I mean, those were in on-premise, pretty traditional. That's what they were obviously super deep in. So they, just like you as a software provider, was going through a business model transformation. They had to as well, right? They had to move to all these different, cloud-based pricing, and we're moving to more subscription and all this kind of fun stuff. So I'm sure that was a big inflection point for the firm itself.
Yeah. So when I procured them to help with my software company, we were on-prem and had been that way for about 10 years. Yeah. And there was a manner of licensing our software that was a little bit different than the named users that became popular after Salesforce and others put it into production in a bigger way. But that had been going on for a lot of years. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But the concurrent user model was one that I was using. And that's basically a shared license. And the history of that is actually pretty cute at the firm. So there were 27 CAD and engineering firms that went through the first pricing projects in the late 80s. Back then, the network had just come online. So you were just untethering yourself from an Ethernet cable. And I think it was Apollo Computing. And then later, Globetrotter came out with the licensing manager that was going to pass out a license on the network. And of course, this is going to break everybody's business model. You used to be able to sit on a desktop tethered to the wall and on a single processor. And I could share it with you, but I had to get up and move and then you'd have to go and sit. Yep. So it was self-regulating and this was going to be the antithesis of that. And so out of that model came a concurrent user pricing strategy that became dominant. That's what I built our software company on. And that's part of the reason why I kind of felt beholden to the firm that had created the strategy that we adopted.
Super interesting history. So now the firm, what are the types of services you provide to a customer? So when we say, under this umbrella of, Software Pricing Partners, how do you help a company?
Well, so we have the design of the strategy and we break that into three parts. And these three parts were first proposed in the 80s and they've sort of defined the language set that we use today. The first one is licensing, but not the legal terms and conditions, but there is a connective tissue there, but it's the thing that you're going to count. In this case, you used users. So the question is, well, what is that? How you define it? Are you going to count an employee user the same as a subcontracting user, the same as a part-time, et cetera? And that definition would appear in the legal license agreement, but it really is the quantity field in the sales contract. And it defines really your valuation. On one side of the spectrum, all you can eat, the quantity is always one. On the other side of the spectrum, I charge you every time you log in and nobody buys. And so the answer somewhere in the middle. Then you have the second discipline, which is packaging. We call that the offering model. How do you put not just the capabilities, but services? You know, we're monetizing intellectual property that comes in different forms. It comes in the form of a product capability, comes in the form of a service, actually comes, interestingly enough, also in the form of insights that you can use to further monetize your offering. And then finally, we have the pricing, which is the harder core science, the modeling, the simulation, and the actual impacts of customer transitions and like who pays what and how much more and what does that look like? And that together is the design of a monetization strategy. And then we also have technology that helps in the operationalizing of that in the tech stack where we monitor the effectiveness of packaging and pricing. But those are reserved for companies that really are turning pricing into a process. And really that was my big journey was it's part of the fabric of how you build a product, but we were never onboarded that way. You know, I was always onboarded that it was product market fit. It was never product market profitability fit. And I just need a number. It's like an attribute that I put, you know, over on that product. And it turns out that that's not the right way to think about that.
Well, so I want to play a little bit of that back because I love that framing there on those three buckets, right? So there's licensing, then I get a package, and then I finally do the pricing. And then once you go through that with a customer to help them think through those pieces, is there an ongoing monitoring component where you come back and like you're checking 6 months, a year later, hey, how did that work? Is the packaging still right? Is the pricing still right? How does, just give me a flavor for that.
So we call that continuous monetization and we launched that around 2020, 2021. And what that is a technology component that drives the pricing calculations for a firm. It allows us to be very agile. We can do a meeting on Friday with a CFO and adjust the pricing and publish a new API key and you're off to the races globally pricing across 1,200 salespeople. And it just makes companies faster. You know, as a publicly traded software company, you'd be lucky to deploy a pricing change like once a year. It's just that the systems are so complicated. Yeah. There's so many SKUs.
Complex.
So we're speeding that up, right? And then secondly, every time that there is a salesperson or customer behavior, so you come in and you say, well, I'd like to check out the Enterprise Edition. I'm going to look at 5,000 units and 15,000 units, whatever those units are, we have to design that, right? And then I bought as a pilot with 150 units. We see that entire journey. We see what you looked at and we see what you didn't look at. And we see the events that yield a win and the events that yield a loss. And we use that to improve the packaging and pricing also. So that continuous nature right now at our firm, after you go through that design stage is an invite only kind of process. And then we team very, very closely with that company and start to work through the rest of the portfolio. But we're turning pricing into a science. We're, as one member of our team here says, we're weaponizing pricing. I'm not a big weaponizing fan, but you know.
You probably don't like that framing.
Yeah, you're trying to, ideally, before you build the product, you know, we all have a roadmap and we prioritize that roadmap. And I used to call it prioritizing by screaming. So that has a certain priority to it. But what you really want to do is you want to dip into that roadmap and you want to say, well, if I was to launch this particular component, what is its monetization potential? Because I might want to build that before this other component.
First.
And the thing with that is it's hard to get to that. You don't get to that day one. First, you got to get out of the Wild West. You got to get some predictability in your net prices. And then after that, you can really start to turn it into
more sophisticated.
Yeah, and subtle nuances, you know, just little changes in the 10th and 100th percent of the decimal place at scale yields massive outcome when the company gets big enough.
Yeah. So you know, are using this word, you know, profitable. And I'm just curious, you and I didn't talk about this, but I just want to put this framing on the table. When I think about all the SaaS companies that we've benchmarked and worked with over the past, you know, decade, profitability was not job number one, as you know. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, right? And what you're describing, I'm just super curious how you would assess this. So what you're describing, this model, right, where you say, I have a licensing, I get a packaging, I do my final pricing, I'm thinking about profitability all the way through that, I release it into the wild, I get more sophisticated, I prioritize my roadmap based on profitability potential. So that is a very mature, nuanced, sophisticated model, right? So let's put that on a scale of 1 to 10. That's like a 10, right? But I am telling you, man, these SaaS companies that I've seen, you know, operating were nowhere close to what you're describing. up until 2022 when the shit hit the fan, right? Then it was something like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So just tell me what your experience has been watching this play out over the past couple of years. I mean, what was it like pre-2022 on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of sophistication of pricing? Were most SaaS companies like a 5, a 4? Because I know they weren't 10s. What did you see?
No, I actually think it's probably in the 1 range. You know, had our software company, we were in the interior product space, and we would take what was a manual process. So think CRM, sales, purchasing, receiving for things mm-hmm. like windows and doors, faucets and fixtures, stairways and railings, roofs and trusses, cabinetry, and all these configurable products. And it was very, very complicated space. But we would take purchasing departments down from like 40 people to 1, like part-time and a backup, right? Because you needed to have a backup in case that person went on vacation. Yeah. But the scale was tremendous. Yeah. And I remember at the time having discussions with people where I would lose a sale because they couldn't come to grips that 38 people that they knew and loved were going to be let go. But that's a phenomenon of like a space age, you know, you're showing up with a rocket ship to bring somebody manual. Yeah. So I think it's like that now. And prior to the 2022 shit show, as you said, and boy, was it crazy. We spent a lot of time fighting the story that there's growth and then there's profitable growth. And you got to be really careful depending on what's in that licensing model, because if you're selling something that has a lot of quantity and then people aren't using a lot of quantity, like eventually when the contraction comes, you're going to have a really big mess with people wanting to right size and all this stuff. And so nobody wanted to hear, it was growth, 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 you know, show me how the revenue is going to climb. And really fighting for decades, even prior to when I arrived, you know, growth trumps a lot of sins. And so all those sins were like uncovered in 2022 and beyond. So now all the phone calls are like profitability, being more thoughtful. Yeah. And I think it really was a catalyst to rocket what I call that, again, product market fit was the orientation that everybody was onboarded in. It's just a symptom, but it's product market profitability fit. It's that third component of that profitable growth that you're seeking. And I think that is going to be really interesting over the next decade, because that really is everybody's focus right now.
You know, the main reason I really wanted to bring you on to Tectonic was to talk about how the pricing models are shifting yet again, if you will. So if you think about it, 2022 starts a whole new discipline around profitable pricing models. And so again, the scale 1 to 10, they're like a 1 or a 2. And they're like, oh my gosh, I need to be at least a 6 or 7 or 8 in how sophisticated I am. So there's been this mad dash over the past 2 years to get better there. And I'm sure a lot of software companies are still clawing out of that in terms of getting the capability in place, getting more sophisticated. And just as they're trying to do that, this next wave of reality has been playing out where, as you know, a lot of companies are user-based pricing. Yeah. And lo and behold, the renewals are coming up. And when the companies they were selling to were always adding more employees, there's natural growth there, no matter what you do with your pricing model, right? Because you have more salespeople, more customer success people, more whatever in play. And now, you know, in tech, definitely our industry itself has been really flatlining on headcount growth. Now there's not natural growth by just charging for users. And that's part of the fiscal reality that these companies have been more conservative. AI is definitely playing out here. It's slowing the number of headcount people are, you know, want to hire or are going to hire. And so now there's this second sort of shock to the system for these software companies to say, oh, you know, not only do I have to have more discipline to get profitability, but now I got to maybe even rethink how I'm pricing, because user-based pricing may not be the winning play. So I'm curious, how are you seeing the second shock start to unfold with the companies that you're working with? How are you thinking about this?
So let's rewind in history a little bit to put that in perspective, because that shock has been an undercurrent for decades. And then you're right, it's starting to really kind of peak up. But let's start the conversation with the typical product management focus of, you know, we have actors. We have a human actor, we have a machine actor. So as early as in those 80s, you know, people were introducing API layers. And what that meant was some of the capabilities would not necessarily be consumed through the UI or the UX. They would be consumed programmatically. Mm-hmm. And early on, a lot of that was just given away for free. And then people started to realize, well, there's like some stuff happening back then. Now I'm just talking 80s, 90s. Yeah. So there's stuff happening back there, and there's a lot of stuff happening back there. And this is not commodity stuff. In fact, maybe this is at the core of an algorithm or an optimization routine or some part that the firm, the software company feels like is the intellectual property. And so people have had API layer pricing for decades. So this machine human actor phenomenon expresses itself in other ways. So for example, in security, there's the concept of an identity. And so we'll just play a little game here. And if I was selling to you and I was charging based on the identities or based on the user licenses, I have an employee that has access, or you have an employee that has access to a couple hundred apps. They need to have that controlled. Then we have a subcontractor that has access to a couple dozen apps. They need to be controlled. The focus in security is often on that human component, but it turns out that on the machine level, like, you can do a lot of damage with a machine identity. In fact, you can do a tremendous amount more damage because you can do it at scale than you can as a human. But if I told you know, Thomas, we're charging based on identities, not users. So this is in the licensing model. And I'm going to count up these identities and say, well, we have human identities and machine identities. And the human identities are, I'll keep math easy, this is not a recommended price point, but $1. And the machine identity is $10. You know, you're going to have a most likely a visceral reaction to that ratio, to that differential. And that visceral reaction is because machine is machine and a human is something valuable. And so what I'm doing is I'm connecting this thread from the monetization approach into the sales part of the discussion. Now, if I played that back the other way and I said, well, the human identity is $1 and the machine identities are 10 cents, you'd probably have a much easier way to do that. But that creates this hard problem that, but my IP is on the machine and it's being accessed by the machine. Yeah, yeah. And my value prop is protecting against, in this case, the machine scaling and doing harm. Like, how do I get paid fairly for that? So this pattern, my point is, has existed for decades, right?
For a while.
For a long time. So the question at its heart then is, now we have a novel new innovation in the AI space that is still very early. It does have reliability issues, and there's a different podcast you can do on, some people think it's going to be like self-conscious next year, and other people are like, you know, I was listening to that MIT professor Darren Acemoglu, I think is his name, and he thinks it's 5% of GDP because, you know, it's just such a narrow range of use cases that it applies to right now, but that will change. So now we hit, it doesn't change, by the way, the fact that everybody's jumping all in and creating all this stuff in the roadmap. So now we have this phenomenon of, how do we get paid fairly for the machine portion? And I just wanted to highlight that what we're looking at when we're monetizing is intellectual property, the delivery of the value, but not monetizing its use. You're monetizing the value from the use. So this is why I hate the term usage-based pricing, but because you don't charge based on the use. I'm going to use your software. I'm going to pull out the value. I'm going to embed it into my workflow back here. I'm going to extract some additional value, and I'm going to go play golf with it, in which case no value creation, or I'm going to like return it back to my company. And that's what you're trying to value. So it's a little bit of a different phenomenon. But that intellectual property comes, like we talked about, in multiple forms. And that piece to the puzzle is the piece that companies have struggled with for decades. In fact, forever. Companies have been charging on a non-user basis. You know, I can think of one in the open source arena in the late 80s, charging based on the number of vulnerabilities you would find in the code, for example. So this usage, this named user, this user-based pricing, I think has been an inefficiency that has sat here for decades. And now it's really starting to come, just like people are starting to come online. Oh my gosh, pricing is a discipline and there's a science to this. Yeah. It's not, you know, as simple as I thought.
So let me play that back, because I mean, you put a lot of really great insights on the table there and things that are, you know, definitely, you know, I'm learning a lot in this conversation. So the fact that charging beyond a user, charging, like you said, for an API access, you know, all those types of things has been on the table for quite a while. And it's been a conundrum that people have had to deal with. One of the escape valves was, well, you know, if we can do something user-based pricing, that's easy. What I heard there, that's super tangible to the customer. They can kind of get it. I've got an employee. They've got access to that software now. I get paying for that. And there's always been this challenge of, well, but if they're paying for something else, like you said, like, you know, if my API is defending against a machine, but what I heard was the value to your company is actually higher because the threat from the machine is higher. I should be charging you more because there's more value, but just emotionally, intellectually, it's hard for customers to wrap their heads around that, right? So that challenge has been on the table for quite a while. And AI is just basically another instance of that challenge, because what you articulated is what I'm hearing from our members is, I'll give you a classic use case. Hey, you know, we provide software to support centers, and these support centers are basically declining their headcount because, you know, the staff can do so much more with these new AI capabilities and they can serve more customers, blah, blah, blah. And we're putting these AI capabilities in, but how do we take the value out because we have this user-based pricing model? So do we just, you know, and we have a tough time just saying, well, we want to, you know, jack up our user price here. So that is the conundrum, is there is incremental value in the software that is doing. How do we take that money off the table and decouple it? Because, you know, I was just in a conversation earlier today with one of our members, and, you know, I said this reality that you have customers that historically, if their revenue grew, their employee base grew with it. You know, there's a very strong correlation there. And now we're seeing this decoupling. Revenue can grow, and then employee base can flatline or sometimes decline. And if you are, again, in a user-based pricing model, that's problematic. And again, the reason I wanted to get you on here, and we've got this conversation going on with our members, is I see this challenge coming. And I think it's going to be a big tsunami for them to deal with. And they're going to have to scramble really fast to do the types of things you're talking about to get way more maturity and way more sophistication around the pricing model, or they're going to be leaving a lot of value on the table. And, you know, this issue of profitability is going to become a problem. So I think it's super interesting times. And the other thing here that, you know, starting to play out is the concept of having more data-driven, analytics-driven, even AI-driven pricing models. So I'm curious what you're seeing, because I know you guys, you know, the history of the firm, you have platforms to help people, software to help with pricing. How do you see software changing the pricing game in terms of how you set your prices?
Well, so when we say AI, we can put a lot of stuff under the umbrella, including LLMs that hallucinate. So we don't use the LLM phenomenon in pricing, because our goal when I came on board was to 100% eliminate Excel. I don't know if you remember the London Whale incident. It was a $6 billion chase mistake from a copy-paste error. So I had this incident when I had my software company where we were testing and we had a hole in our testing process, and a rounding issue occurred on a purchase order calculation. And by the time that our customer and we had found it, we had already accumulated $32,000 of losses. That was only after like a day and a half or something like, I was very panicked at that time.
And was not I can imagine.
Right. And thank God customer was very understanding, and we ended up extending their term. But that could have been millions at scale across the rest of the customers. Yeah. And so when we were using Excel, when I first came on board, and that was kind of the history of it, you know, I just had this terror. And so what started as an internal tool for us just became an edict of just nothing but the highest degree of accuracy. Like the worst case phenomenon is we're messing with somebody's revenue model and we have a rounding error or something. Somebody copies and pastes some transaction data or does something goofy. So Level Setter is our platform, and it carries with it some machine learning components. Yep. And those machine learning components are patterned after how net prices scale at volume based on our research and our understanding of customers' ability and willingness to take down lots of quantity of software, not just user-based, but, you know, if you think about the history, we were getting into, you know, if I discover a million bugs this year, like, what does that look like? And so these scaling issues have kind of, we had a lot of stuff in Excel to handle that. And that was what the terror, that was the reminder. Now, I think it was fine, and I'm sure it was, but that was the reminder. So part of then bringing the sophisticated technology to bear is that there really is not, there are things that we do with our algorithms that don't work well in the Office suite. And then secondarily, my mission then became, how do I get rid of PowerPoint? Like, how do I get you to viscerally experience a model? So for example, you log in, you use a quoting system as your model comes online, and you know what the different licensing metrics are. We don't just IBM fellow put our feet up on the desk and say, oh, I think this would be great qualitatively. We consume the usage data. We do a lot of modeling. We do a lot of simulation, and we're playing out revenue impacts. And what we learned over the years is that there are a lot of answers to a problem when it comes to recommended pricing. And it turns out there is an optimal. And so one of the biggest things that we do is we determine that optimal. So if I'm going to give you a pricing model, I can give you a pricing model that just absolutely wreaks havoc in customer transition with large price differentials because this customer got a 40% discount, that customer got an 80% discount. And now when it comes time for my new cloud offering that maybe isn't on-prem, and I want to get you to that promised land, the price differential is so large that you're just never going to go without special treatment. And so what we do is we compute and compress that so that I can give you a model by saying, this is the best possible outcome. This absolutely greases the skids from old to new, because if you're going to change pricing, you got to figure out how not to trap legacy customers, because what you really want to have happen is you launch the new model, you stimulate new profits and new revenue for new customers, and then your older customers over time say, man, that new offer has a ton of value in it. I'd like to upgrade. Right. And of course, upgrade is more revenue. And if you remember your water skiing days or wake boarding days, there's a thing called the double up. Like there's a pattern that you drive the boat in and two waves collide and create this really big wave that you can do all these crazy tricks and jumps on. And so we were trying to create that double up, and it's very hard to create that double up if the price differentials are too big, but now we can do that.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, when you're describing the double up, I can tell you, I can assure you, I've never made it. I could barely stand up on water skis, so I've never made it through a double up, but yeah, I'll kill myself. But the, as you're describing that, you know, there are companies I've spoken to historically that, you know, they're going through the transition you're talking about. I had all this on-prem software. I now have SaaS. I'm moving customers over. And about halfway through that, they're calling, they're saying, hey, Thomas, like, what are other companies doing? Because I've got this customer who has a bunch of stuff they're not really using that we sold them in the old model. Mm-hmm. It's shelfware. I'm moving them to the new model and they don't need it. So they're not going to, you know, move that stuff over to a subscription, right? And like, how do I basically keep the ARR the same, you know, as I move them? And so they're like describing this. And I said, let me play that back. I said, you're asking me what's the best practice to get people to pay for stuff they're not using. I just want to make sure that's the ask, right? And they're like, well, no, it's not. That's not what I'm asking. I'm like, no, that's what you're asking, right? But I think that I'm telling you that story because I think there are a lot of software companies who have just been like stumbling through that transition of what is the model, what you just described, what is the optimal pricing model to move legacy to the new, to keep as much money on the table as possible, to keep it fair to the customers, like you said, to incent the ones, et cetera. And I think it has been a very blunt instrument for a lot of these software companies. And about halfway through the transformation, they start to have these oh shit moments around their revenue. Because they're like, oh, this new model is, and we've been screaming this for years, like, folks, you have to understand, the margin profile of SaaS is lower than on-prem software for a whole host of reasons. And so what is your pricing model and your business model? You know, how are you accounting for that, right? Most people did not. They did very rough math and just got caught in the middle of it. And I'm sure you get involved with companies that are halfway through it, starting to realize they have a problem. Then that's when they're calling you going, hey, like, this isn't working out for us.
Yeah. And that's a terrible scenario and a hallmark of what happens when the homework assignment wasn't done. And specifically that homework assignment was taking our firm hundreds of hours of Excel and all, and using Excel for think about it, like order level data. You've got a header, deal record, and details, and SKUs climbing out your noses. Like to do that in Excel is absurd, and it's just not conducive to doing what we call an impact analysis. And that impact analysis is something that we compute automatically in our software. So every model we ever do just carries, it just gears every decision we ever make is that impact. And so we can have a very discrete conversation around those impacts, where they occur, what channel, what customers, what are the characteristics? And you want to do that before you start. So the worst case scenario is you made a bunch of assumptions, you start converting, and then the revenue isn't there. Now, when we get a call, we have to deal with old world pricing, which probably has an event or two of a price change in its history. Plus you're a quarter or halfway through this event, which is yet another drama thing to deal with in the customer base. And now you got to correct the ship and come out with the future. So you've got like multiple points to kind of converge. And all, oh, by the way, you've got to do that in a way that customers don't get really pissed off. And it's really hard to tease out causality in that scenario, because And this is where the analytics come into play. You've got to get something that says, is that new thing that I'm creating better than the old thing that I had? So for example, just literally, we're in an engagement right now. This happens to be from a competitor's recommendations. We consumed the price points, everything else, ran it through the, and we can do this very quickly, and just said, this is a earth-shattering no. Like, the price differentials are so absurdly high, you're going to impact demand. And that's the challenge with PowerPoint. Like, it looks great and it looks clean, but like, the FP&A team then has to take that, consume it, and say, what does this mean for 2,200 customers or whatever the number is? And that's actually where a lot of the science comes into play. Now, some that show up to the party don't have that transaction data. Maybe they move 30 deals a year, or maybe they're just launching a brand new product.
Yeah, low volume.
You still want to take forecast data or maybe some competitive intelligence gathering, provided it was done ethically, and start to model. And that's the piece that I think that I did some Excel work when I had my company, but I didn't know pricing. So you just kind of build these funky models and you put stuff together and away you go. And just something as simple as, like, let's say I'm going to offer tiered pricing. I'm going to give you a usage model and the quantities are going to go up into the tens of thousands, let's say. And I'm sure you've seen the little tiered pricing, like, well, you know, from 0 to 100, it's this much, from 101 to 250. Yep. And it strangely always has this cadence, 250, 500, 1,000. And it turns out that cadence is total bullshit, and because somebody thought it looked pretty. But the problem that's happening is, it looks pretty, but the tier widths are getting ever wider. And the rate at which it looks pretty and your price goes from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 creates a really bizarre mathematical effect, which is totally hokey and wrong and not great. And it also changes buying behavior. So, but just something as simple as me constructing a tier actually impacts the revenue outcome, like upwards of almost 20%. In fact, many of our projects, Thomas, are just, let's just clean up your tiers. They can clearly see they don't follow any structure. They were manually created and they're a mess. So let's just clean that up and go give you a 15, 20% profit boost, cheer to the investors, and then use that money to fund other efforts to clean up the larger issues around, do we want to change the licensing metric from users to something else? Do we want to change our packaging and our SKU structure and our sales ops supporting systems and all the stuff that gives everybody like a nightmare that this is going to be a big change?
Yeah. Yeah, that's helpful. And again, it's just continuing this theme of way more sophistication, way more data-driven, way more modeling, as opposed to just arbitrarily picking, you know, tiers or whatever price points. You know, one thing I wanted to get on the table with you is the first time you and I ever spoke, we talked about this discounting problem that it typically exists within software companies. And it leads to something, and I've heard you say this on other podcasts, like this market fairness issue. So what is that concept?
Well, so sometimes market fairness is confused with charge everybody the same thing. And that's not what that is. It's a concept talked about, and it's been around for decades. And it sort of became popular off a blog article that we wrote. I think it was around 2015, 2016. And market fairness was that, so let's talk about value and defending price. And I'll use a consumer example, even though I'm committing a cardinal sin because we're talking about B2B and they're really different. I was at a conference and I was speaking at the Business of Software, and I'll say this over and over again at all the speaking engagements: raise your hand if you received a discount when you bought your iPhone 16 this year. And of course, nobody ever raises their hand. And the message there is that if somebody did raise their hand, guess where everybody would buy their next iPhone from? And now it's not a $2,600 phone or a $1,600 phone. Now it's a $1,400 and a $1,200 and a $1,000. And you can just follow that down the toilet bowl until eventually it's really difficult to defend price, because everybody's showing up at your establishment saying, but Brad at the other store, like, he's going to give me 80% off. So should I just drive there? Yeah. And it's just really, it's not a willingness to pay issue, which is an academic exercise in futility. It turns out it's almost impossible to determine that. There's something called a conjoint where you can get close, but this idea you can figure that out is total BS. There's just no scientific underpinning to it. We come at that by looking at willingness to discount. Because when you're willing to discount, what happens is you put a data point out in the field that enterprise edition at that quantity isn't $1 million, you can actually get it for $800,000. And over here, you can get it for $600,000. Over here, if you buy at the end of the quarter, you can actually get it for $250,000. And it turns out that buyers can discover this information. We have a whole CI practice, competitive intelligence practice. It's all done ethically. You never want to mystery shop a competitor. That's a violation of federal and state law here in the U.S. You'll totally get your butt sued on that. I mean, there's many examples of that happening in the market and lawsuits. And you want to instead talk to competitors' customers. That's just an extension of customer research. But when you go through that journey, you have to be so very careful about the data that you use to drive the model. And so in summary, I worry sometimes that at the larger picture, in the goal of producing the great product, we lose sight of where we're getting the information and the inputs that we're putting into the model. And monetization, put simply, is also just stepping back and injecting other things that you wouldn't normally think about into your decision-making quadrant. And I think that's also kind of the spirit of this podcast as well. But
the thing about fairness, and I'll just give you an anecdote with our own business. When we started this, you know, almost 20 years ago, so two things you said, right? I mean, you know, people can find out what other people pay. They'll figure that out. So if you're discounting one customer, you know, 40%, the other, you know, got zero discount, there, the market is going to talk. But secondly, it doesn't mean that everybody pays the same. So what we did, you know, 20 years ago, we have a tier-based pricing model based on company size. So if you're a larger company, more employees accessing our research, et cetera, you pay more. But it's tiered based on a fair thing, you know, company size. But within that tier, the price is the price. And I will never forget, as long as I live, when we were just launching, we were, you know, just maybe 10 customers in, and about the 11th customer was a very large company, very well-known technology company. And the gentleman we were talking to said, well, what's our price, right? Because we're so-and-so, right? And our brand is worth so much, and we're, you know, we're going to add so much credibility to you. What's our special price? And we said, the price. the price is the price. Because you're this size, and you know, and we held the line on that. We've done it, you know, ever since. And I'm telling you, that has served us very well. And I always coach every person I'm ever talking to about, you know, pricing is discounting is a problem, which leads to another, you know, question here is, so if you have lumpy discounting, there are fairness issues. Customers will talk. It creates a lot of, you know, challenges there. But I'm, you know, one of the things that creates discounting specifically in software, as you know, and you already articulated it, is, oh my God, it's the end of the quarter. It's the end of the year. Oh my God, this salesperson goes, I'm telling you, our customer can't afford that. I'm telling you, we got to drop, you know, our pants here. We got to give them 40%, 50%, 80%, whatever. And so there's this sort of human factor that comes in the pricing that creates deal by deal, all these snowflake deals, right? With snowflake discounting. Do you think that ultimately a more model, data-driven, analytics-driven pricing model starts to wring out, I'll say, the human component on pricing? So companies start looking at their sales executives and say, look, this is what the model says. That's what we're going with.
Yes.
You know, what's your thinking
so
there?
So this kind of does, it does connect back with market fairness as well. So let's put the buying at the end of the quarter as a phenomenon at the side. That's a marketplace behavior change where people are realizing there can be a deal had. But let's rewind with the job of the monetization model, licensing, packaging, and pricing. So if we have a decent metric, then we should be able to scale a reasonable and rational list price for a deal. And of course, this is where when quantities get really large, things can become quite absurd. So when we talk about discounting, I think we want to just adopt a slightly nuanced nomenclature. So let's take a tour through the company's price book, if you will, or the sort of the journey starting at the list price. So if I toured through the company's price book, I'd realize, oh, you bought at this quantity, so you're going to earn this kind of an incentive. Notice I'm using this term incentive, not discount. And then you're willing to buy for the full year upfront. Our standard payment terms are quarterly, but you're willing to
another incentive.
And so out of that journey comes this thing called a structured net price, or a set of structured incentives that have given us a scheduled net price. It's not the landed net price. It's the scheduled net price. Mm-hmm. It's the point at which we desire to be because we have profitability goals. So this is wrapping in not product market fit, product market profitability fit. It turns out that most software companies cannot produce that. So it doesn't work. Or let's just take something like we have two products. We came up with one product 6 months later. It has volume pricing, but product number one doesn't have volume pricing. So now I'm a salesperson. I'm supposed to sell you both products. And I show up to the door and my company's tour through the price book gives me a scheduled net of, you know, this actually happened to me, 6.7 million a month. It was to the CIO of Masco. And he said, Chris, every time you call, I take it. You know, the other vendors, I'm saying no, but here's the thing. I'm not writing you a check for $6.7 million a month. To which I was like, well, let's talk. Let's figure out, like, how do I land this? And yeah. But I didn't have any of the mechanics. I didn't know what I didn't know yet because I hadn't hired software pricing partners. Yeah. And so that scheduled net price is missing. And so when it's missing, the salesperson or the team, let's say we have a 100-person salesperson team, shows up to a deal with the big telecom vendor and says, this is great. I got 6.7 million in list. If I tell them 6.7 million list, I think they're going to laugh me out of the office. So I'm going to adjust and create my own scheduled net price. Turns out they have a nonprofit arm. I'll throw them an extra 2%. In other words, they're creating, they're extending the company's subpar pricing model with their own rules.
You can't fault them.
You can't fault them.
You can't fault them.
But what happens is every team of salespeople is doing something different. And then when we step back and look, it's freaking chaos, which is why as a buyer, sometimes they call and then they call back, talk to somebody else and get a different deal. So that phenomenon of the scheduled net, now it enters the salesperson's arena. That's what they're supposed to be given to go to market, right? But they don't. So now they're at that scheduled net price, let's say in this 6.7 million example, now they're at 1 million. Then they enter the sales process and then they'll do their discretionary discount, of which maybe we have a deal desk or a little, you know, you can do up to 5%, mm-hmm. your manager can do 10%. In essence, what our technology and what our practice does is we're equipping the company with the ability to produce a scheduled net price for everything that is sold. That then becomes the marker in the sand so that we can tell the salespeople, just get within X percent of the scheduled net price. And by the way, if you don't, mm-hmm. you aren't getting a commission. So that's just like paying on profitability. I'm not paying on revenue anymore. That's the mechanic that's happening right now as we shift and align the sales team to be on the same playbook. But you can't do that if you don't give the salespeople the whole playbook. And I can tell you, you know, 500 grand landed deal on a million is a 50% discount. 500 grand on a 6.7 million. I mean, that's two completely different pictures. And so just untangling that is a big part of getting the market fairness down. Now, once we have that, behavior starts to align. We start to tether those deals to that scheduled net price. Now that we're tethered and we can land and forecast our net revenues, our net profit also, reasonably, and it's like coming in, we have predictability in the model. Well, then and only then can we get paid fully, fairly for our value. And market fairness is also speaking about the software company getting paid. You will never get paid fairly for your enterprise edition if you charge this guy 120% as a surcharge and that guy at a 99% or a 90% discount. I've seen discounts absurdly high, and that stuff is out in the market. You're just not ever going to be able to substantiate and get paid for your value.
Yeah. You know, as I listen to you, the thing that sprung into my mind is I'm thinking about all of these, you know, really sharp sales executives are out there. And, you know, what you're describing, again, they've been filling a gap for us in the industry, right? Their creativity and their, you know, Matt, throw this here, throw this, you know, like you said, you know, not probably, whatever. Yeah. I throw it in and I get a deal that kind of passes the sniff test with the deal desk or finance or whatever. And then boom, I get across the line. They're doing a lot of work there, right? And the big question in my mind, in the world that you're describing, which I think I am completely simpatico, it is going to be way more data-driven, way more focused on an anchor that is going to get the profitability. You get the salespeople to say, that's the number. You get commission when you get close to that number, all that, right? And the question mark is, now, if I'm a sales executive, you could go one of two ways on that world. One way would be you say, oh, thank God, finally we got our pricing act together. I don't have to do all this creative spinning and guessing and like, I know what to run to. Just let me run to that and get that fair price across the goal line, right? So that could be one reaction. The other reaction could be,
War three.
Oh my God. Well, yeah, I don't want you boxing me in, right? This is my value to the company is I'm Mr. Creative, right? I get the wheel and deal and you're taking all of the wheeling and dealing off the table. We're going to end on this question. I am just super curious because you're in the guts of this with companies in a way that I am not. Is you take a company closer to the model that we're articulating, you know, where you're creating the anchor price, et cetera. What do you see from the sales team's reaction to that? Is it that fork in the road?
Well, yeah. So that largely depends on who you include during the design phase of the monetization strategy. And you've got to get sales. So when you're ideating a metric, so we have a vast library, we'll get stuff, you'll see what the competitors are doing. They're all making it up, by the way. But when you look at the metric change process, like I'm moving off of users, the reason that salespeople freak out and the reason that most service providers underestimate this is because you've literally pulled the rug out from underneath their feet when it comes to objections. So let me give you an example. If I was charging you based on users, you've got your playbook as sales. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to say, and we'll be ridiculous, I'm going to charge you based on the number of footsteps you take next year. So you're going to have sales revolt on this. So when you shift a metric like that, now if instead I was able to equip the sales team with something like, well, look, we have a little bit of a template to walk through. Like, Thomas, are you a jogger or a runner? Well, I'm a runner. Do you do like 5Ks or 10? I like 10Ks. Do you do like 3, 4? I do 5 of those a year. Okay, well, based on that, it sounds like you take 250,000 steps a year. Does that sound right? That connective glue, again, to the sales process says that the salesperson didn't sell you on the estimate. You bought into the rationale of the buildup of the estimate. And so I have neutralized your perception of risk when it comes to misestimating. But like, I can't give that to an average 10-year, 1 year out of college sales team. I don't think, you know, if I give that to a curmudgeon-y old enterprise rep that's been around, you know, in a group that's been around for forever, like they're going to kill that like all day long because they're very sophisticated, can have a really deep conversation. Yeah. So my point of bringing this up is, and why you don't ever copy the competition. Not only are you copying the blueprint of risk, but like if I had two identical companies, two identical code bases, everything about them, founder and investors, identical, 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 identical. And there's only one thing that's different, the sales team and the experience, right? Two different strategies. And that's, I think, what people miss is how you monetize has more to do with how you want to sell. So going back the other way, the easiest thing for me to sell is, you know, Thomas, the unit quantity is one, here's the price, and I really don't care what you do in the software, go nuts. You'll never get an upsell, you'll never get a cross sell because I've given you everything, right? But it's the easiest thing to sell. On the other side, the hardest thing to sell that gives you the most value are these quantities that are like in the millions or billions or whatever, you know, hundreds of millions, right? If we're dealing with the infrastructure layer, like how do I get you comfortable with that? And how do I make it so like 1 month you don't get a $6 million bill and the next month you get a $50,000 bill? Because customers won't withstand that kind of yin and yang, right? And so, but to extract that with the sales team is going to be a very different picture than the other one, but it's going to yield a much bigger upside. So that's the piece that I think is often missed around that. So once you engage the sales team in that dialogue and they realize, ooh, I've got a gradient to play in and this really does match, then what you'll see in the data, provided you get the right recommendations out, is a wonderful thing called deal velocity. They'll close 5 deals in the time that the competitor is nickel and diming on all the little detailed nuances of super accurate pricing to get that extra nickel. So they'll close 5 deals, competitor closes 1, and that's just a very, very different commission structure for them, even on the existing comp plan.
Interesting. So at the very end here, you put this new variable on the table, which I think is nuanced but really important, which is what type of sales force do I have? What are the capabilities there? And ultimately, my pricing model has got to be aligned to those go-to-market capabilities. And if I have a mismatch there, I'm going to have a real problem getting the sales team to lean into a pricing model that just does not align with the way they operate.
Yeah, I think the definition here of a successful monetization strategy, which is the combination of the licensing, the packaging, and the pricing, it is for sales enablement. It is connected directly to that sales dialogue. If you don't understand that, if you haven't sold software for a decade, if you don't know how that language flows, it's too academic. And salespeople will rightfully revolt.
Yeah, I totally get that. Well, hey, Chris, this has been a killer conversation. I really enjoyed some of the rabbit trails we went down there. Again, I think that these are going to be interesting and challenging times for software companies in terms of pricing. I think that everyone's going to have to move off of being a 1 or a 2 in terms of their maturity and sophistication. They're going to have to be 7s, 8s, 9s, and 10s if they want to play the game. I mean, I think the ones that don't figure this out are going to be, they're going to go out of business. They're not going to be profitable. They are going to get gobbled up by somebody else. But, you know, I think stakes are high here for a lot of these software companies right now. So I appreciate you sharing your insights on this. I always like to end with the question of the day. And so my question for the audience is, are your current pricing models optimized to maximize profitability? Cheers, everybody.